For the benefit of anyone present who has not been here over the past few Sundays, we are wrapping up a series of sermons about the first 11 chapters of Genesis, known to biblical scholars as the mythology section, a rich tapestry of vivid stories about a time before normal human history began to be written. The final myth in this part of the Bible, familiar to those of you who won gold stars for perfect attendance at Sunday school, is about an ancient enemy of Israel who built the Tower of Babel, and how the Jewish God, Yahweh, broke up that project by confusing their language. It's a fascinating fable, and we'll consider it together in a moment. But I need to preface it with a comment about two different kinds of knowledge. Some kinds of knowledge are practical, like learning how to use a computer, or drive a car, or open a tight jar lid by tapping it on the countertop. Other kinds of knowledge may have little or no practical use, like two essays I just read in the National Geographic about human origins and about the incredible maze of tunnels underneath Manhattan, and an article in another favorite magazine, the Smithsonian, about the interesting life of dung beetles. There isn't much I can do with those pieces of information, but they were a joy to read, and they fed my curiosity about the wonders of the world I live in. Today's sermon is in the non-practical category. It won't help you be a better parent, or spouse, or neighbor, but if you wonder at all about how some parts of the Bible were composed, it will feed that curiosity and increase the joy of being alive. So tune in for a few minutes, really concentrate, and let's see what we can make of a strange little story which found its way into our Bible. Its nine verses, which tell about the Tower of Babel, are the last pieces of primitive folklore before we leave the early chapters of Genesis and enter the real world. For several weeks, we've talked about the fabled Garden of Eden with its talking snake and the angry God whose creation goes so sour that he decides to wipe it out in a flood and start over. But once we finish today's story and turn the page to meet a man named Abraham, the world is suddenly much more normal. Whereas people in the first 11 chapters of Genesis were said to live as much as an incredible 900 years, the moment we enter history with Abraham in chapter 12, the lifespans become believable. But for one more Sunday morning, we are still in the world of mythology, in a story that begins in the New English Bible with the words you heard earlier when Ted read the scripture text for this morning. Once upon a time, all the world spoke a single language and used the same words. And as they migrated from the east, they came to a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. This plain in the land of Shinar is actually the great alluvial valley between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers of what was once known as Babylonia. The Greeks called it Mesopotamia, land between the rivers. It is now called Iraq, from an Arabic word meaning origin, a reference to the ancient cultures that flourished on those plains, which archaeologists call the cradle of civilization. The author says next that having settled there, the people said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them hard." And then, because he's writing for an audience in Palestine who had lots of stones for building use, he adds a little footnote about a strange country where builders had to make bricks out of clay and bake them in the sun or burn them in a kiln and then cement them together with pitch or asphalt. Then for the second time, he has these exotic foreigners say, "Come, let us do something." This time, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the sky and make a name for ourselves, or we shall be scattered all over the earth." It will turn out that in this writer's view, the scattering these proud city people are trying to prevent is exactly what his God Yahweh wants. So he tells us next that Yahweh came down to see the city and the tower which mortal men had built. If someone is not familiar with the word Yahweh, it will help to know that it was Israel's favorite name for their God. It's unfortunate, in my opinion, that only a few English translations print it. Most of them translate it as Lord in block capital letters. To have the author say that this God Yahweh came down to look things over, instead of having him know everything without the need of a personal visit, is simply one more piece of evidence that this is ancient folklore in which God still has very human qualities. When Yahweh sees the impressive building that is going on, he becomes worried. "From now on," he says, "there is no telling what these people might do, and they need to be stopped right away by having their language confused so they can't understand each other anymore." This seems an odd thing for an omnipotent God to say. Why should such a divinity be worried about anything? But remember that this is the same writer who told us earlier how Yahweh did not want the first humans to eat a certain fruit for fear they would become like gods, and how after they did eat and became wise, he drove them out of the garden. So the author continues his favorite theme of a God greatly concerned about human arrogance and ambition, and has this God now mimic the words the humans have used. "Come, let us go down there and confuse their speech so that they will not understand what they say to one another." Then he tells us that Yahweh scattered them from that place all over the earth so that they stopped building the city. The natural question right now would be, why is this God so worried about human ambition? Fearful that if these city builders continue to speak a single language, there will be no limits to what they can do. Well, for one thing, there is some evidence that back in the days when they were nomads and farmers, the Hebrew people thought very poorly of cities. The early Genesis legend has Cain, a murderer, become the founder of the first city. And there is certainly a strong hint in this Tower of Babel story that the primitive Hebrew God wants his creation scattered and not huddled up together in a place like the Big Apple. So in this myth, he confuses their language so they can't communicate and have to quit building the city, which the author tells us in one of his many verbal puns was called Babel because it was there that the God Yahweh made a babel of earth's languages. One thing you can learn from a story like this is that these early folk tales were not nearly as solemn as our Sunday school teachers made them out to be. Scholars versed in the Hebrew language will tell you that this story, like so many others in the early parts of the Bible, is full of clever little puns, that literary device called assonance, a very artful arrangement of consonants, and a few other linguistic tricks, which means that the author was having fun and meant for his original audience to have fun with him. Touches that are lost when the story gets translated into another language. If it is annoying to be asked to take this on faith, you can always read commentaries by great German scholars like Gerhard von Rad and Klaus Westermann, or one by Umberto Casuto, who taught Hebrew at the University in Jerusalem, or my personal favorite by a fine Catholic scholar named Bruce Vauter. They will all amaze you by pointing out how much verbal game playing went into the telling of these stories. As you can guess, I had to fight myself all week to keep from taxing your patience by demonstrating some of them, but I do want you to realize how wrong those evangelists are who tell you what a simple book the Bible is. When as a child I first heard this story about people planning to build a tower with its top in the heavens, as our old King James Version translated it, I accepted my preacher's extremely literalistic interpretation that the folks in Babylon were actually plotting to pierce the clouds and walk right in on God's living quarters. But the author really does not even hint at this. From his opening tale about Adam and Eve, through the story of their son Cain, and on through the story of the great flood, he has emphasized the enormous danger of human pride, of ambition overreaching itself. And that's exactly what he's doing again in this story. He has heard about the ruined cities of Babylon, including the great pyramidal towers they built, and it's his belief that they fell into decay because his God would not tolerate such proud ambition. When he speaks of the city, he probably has Babylon's famous capital city itself in mind. And when he speaks of the tower, he is undoubtedly describing the terraced temples built in other cities throughout the Babylonian Empire. Any good encyclopedia or dictionary will show a picture of these temples called ziggurats, which rose in stepped or terraced stages to a kind of shrine at the very top, where it was thought the gods came down from their lofty dwelling places to interact with worshipers. The Flemish painter Peter Bruegel imagined in a stunning painting what these temple towers may have looked like. And I'm going to leave this reproduction of that painting on the table for those of you too far back to see it, in case you care to take a look at it. Whatever may have been its exact appearance, and they differed some from city to city, the one in Babylon certainly impressed the Greek historian Herodotus when he saw it about 4.5 centuries before the birth of Christ. He describes how an ascending walk around the outside of the tower, it made me think of some great baseball stadia I have been in, leads one to the top with a resting place midway for people to stop for a while and catch their breath. On the topmost level, he says, there is a spacious temple with a bed for the chief of the Babylonian gods named Marduk. The walls of this particular temple tower, we are told, were plated with gold and decorated with enameled brickwork of a bluish hue, which glittered in the sun, greeting the traveler's eye from afar. Modern historians say that these ziggurats were built to honor the gods, not to be in competition with them, that instead of pride and arrogance, they were a symbol of humanity's reaching out toward divinity and of humanity's hope that the gods would come through the gate at the top to visit. Even Jewish people, at certain points in their history, shared that hope. The prophet Isaiah once cried out to his God, "Oh, that you would split the heaven, that you would come down." Seen that way, the Babylonian ziggurats appear no different from the cathedrals we build, or the New England colonial churches with their tall spires. But our ancient Hebrew author of this particular story, obsessed with sin, interprets the whole thing differently. We have to remember, in his behalf, that by the time he wrote this story, Babylon, with its power and pride, and because of its oppression of the Jewish people, had become the most hated single name in their vocabulary. So naturally, they responded favorably to the thought that those cities, by their time in ruins, had been made that way by an unhappy God. What to the Babylonians may have been a hand stretched out in supplication, a cry to the heavens for help, was for him just one more example of inflated human ego. To sum it up, he probably wanted to do 3 things. One, which seems to have been incidental, was to explain the origin of languages. He had no knowledge of scientific theories about linguistics and would probably have ignored them anyway. In his world, God is responsible for everything, and therefore God must have caused all our different languages and dialects for some good reason of his own. A second purpose, as I've already suggested, was to showcase his conviction that the hated Babylonian Empire got too proud and was punished by the one true God. If he could have known about Rome's pride in its military power, or the confident British predictions in the 19th century that there would always be an England, or Hitler's boast that the Third Reich would last 1,000 years, or the peculiar arrogance which speaks of America as God's country, he would have enjoyed adding those to his rebuke of human ego. But perhaps the best interpretation, finally, is that he was using his little parable as a teaching device to show how his Jewish countrymen understood God's plan for the world. Out of this scattered humanity, God would choose one tribe, and out of that tribe, one man, Abraham, to be the father of a chosen people who would teach mankind about the one and only true God. All the rest of Genesis will deal with Abraham and his descendants. The Old Testament, we must remember, was never meant as a scientific history of the world. It was created by people convinced that God had elected them to save the world, and for whom everything they see or hear about is interpreted in light of their unique faith. And so ends the first 11 chapters of Hebrew sacred writing, chapters which, far from being original, borrowed from a wide stock of common religious ideas in the world around Israel, and then modified them to express Israel's own theology. A somber thread is woven all through these chapters, that human beings, meant to use their powers responsibly, are forever tempted to put themselves at the center of existence and find security in themselves. In some ways, I suppose it now sounds as quaint and old-fashioned as the motto one modern country has engraved on its currency, "In God we trust," words that may be as difficult to relate to the way we actually live as the ancient story we have just talked about. Thank you for being patient and attentive during this 6-sermon series on the earliest legends of the book of Genesis. A new series begins next week from the New Testament, in which you will be invited to meet the man who influenced Christianity and what it would be like more than any other single person during the first 300 years of its existence. You will also meet our new associate minister, Gary Cox, who with his family will be presented next Sunday as special new additions to the UCC family. So please come back.